But end of the day, the sky really is the limit. And when these students understand that they're going into college and they have rights and they deserve to use them, that's the difference, because I had to figure that out for myself.
The flag with hearts to before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
So here I am with Adela Kochav.
Hi, Shai.
How you doing?
Good. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us, for joining me here. Adela, I'm going to start with the first question that I ask everyone. Adela, what kind of a Jew are you?
What kind of Jew am I? That is a great question. I'd say I'm proudly a diaspora Jew. I am a Syrian, Lebanese, Mexican, Canadian Jew.
Wait. Say that again slowly for the people in the back.
Syrian, Lebanese, Mexican, Canadian Jew.
Can you walk me through all those links?
Yeah, so my family was originally in Syria and Lebanon, and they left Syria and Lebanon, as many Jews had to, as you know. You know, oppression and whatnot, not a fun time. Yeah. And my dad's family went straight from Syria to Mexico, but my mom's family went from Syria through Canada to get to Mexico. Happens to be my mom was born in Canada, but she grew up her whole life in Mexico. My parents got married in Mexico. Big Mexican Jewish community. I was born, and then we moved to the States. So I'm a Syrian, Lebanese, Mexican, Canadian Jew.
What does that mean to be a diasporic Jew?
So it's a little bit of a hot take these days, especially with Jewish discourse around, you know, should we all be making Aliyah? Should we stay behind and fight? I'm very much a diaspora Jew. I think as much as Jews can't exist without Israel, Israel can't exist without the diaspora.
Why?
Well, if we want to get into all those reasons, I think...
I mean, what does that mean for you?
What that means for me is speaking on two different levels. Number one, if all Jews in the world made Aliyah, we would strengthen Israel, and that's true, but we would leave a void in every single other country of the world. And I think it's really easy that when countries don't necessarily have a stake, they don't see justice. So if they don't have... Now, it's not about lobbying, but if we don't have people in those countries that are saying, well, these are the reasons why Israel should exist, and every pro-Israel argument is coming from Israel itself, then I don't think that Israel would have a chance of making any sort of ally. And as strong as Israel could be, there's only 16 million Jews in the world, right? And when you put that into perspective, I really think that the diaspora is a key part of the existence of the state of Israel. But outside of Israel, just for myself, you know, being a Jew of the world, at this point in the United States, Jews have fought for their civil rights and they've earned them. So why are we going to cede that territory? Why are we going to willingly relinquish rights that we've earned? And why is it that Jews have been at the forefront of every civil rights movement, fighting for the rights of others, but when it comes to our own rights, we're so afraid to stand for them? We'd rather throw in the towel and say, well, maybe we don't belong. And I think that that's a fight or flight response that's ingrained within us because of Jewish history. I think that, again, Jewish history, if you were in the Middle East, if you were in Europe, at some point, being Jewish made you different, being different made you a target, and so you had to flee or hide your Judaism. But the existence of the state of Israel gives us the third option to stay and fight, and that third option can't exist without the state. Because if it wasn't for Israel, you only have hide or flee, because you're a perpetual guest. But once you know that you have a footing in the world, you have the power, the empowerment to stay and fight. So I'm using Israel and my Zionist identity to stay here and fight and make sure that Jews are never left behind in the United States and hopefully not in the world.
We jumped right into this.
Right
so
in.
So I love it.
No,
so let's zoom back a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, Adela, who are you? How did you get into this fight for Jewish civil rights?
So that's a good question. So in terms of who am I is, you know, I don't know how much you know about the Mexican Jewish community. And most Jews they meet here in the U.S. don't even know that there's Jews in Mexico. And then I'll meet people from Mexico and they'll say, I didn't know we had Jews. And I'm like, yep, we're everywhere. But the Mexican Jewish community is very strong, very Zionist, and very united. It, like, all the communities are sectioned off in that they have, you have the Turkish community, the Moroccan, but unlike the United States, we have a central committee that oversees all the communities and everyone consents to it. And we understand that we're stronger united as a community.
Where are they centered? Around Mexico City?
Mexico City.
Other cities where you have big communities?
There's also a community in Monterrey, but it's much smaller. Mm-hmm. But the Mexico City community, so you understand, I was in Atlanta at a random event, and when I said I was from Mexico City, this group of women got really excited, and they said, we just got back. I said, oh, what were you doing in Mexico City? A group of, you know, 45, 50-year-old women. And they said, well, we went on a mission to take notes because the community is so strong that we want to replicate it here in Atlanta.
How big? Do you have an idea?
About 30,000.
35. So it's not a big community.
Nope. It's not a big community.
But it's a strong community.
Or actually maybe 60. Got to double check those numbers.
I'll fact check you. But what are the characteristics of like a strong Jewish community in the diaspora?
Well, I think that one of the things that makes the Mexican community distinct from the U.S., and it's not better or worse, but the reason why it became so strong is because there's really no risk of assimilation. Jews participate in the world. They participate in the world economically, in the world of business. But end of the day, the Jewish students go to Jewish schools. The Jewish students are all friends with each other. Everyone in the community knows each other, and they all stand up for each other. And if you want to see how this can be replicated in the United States, take a look at the Syrian community. So I left the Mexican community in Mexico to the Syrian Jewish community of Deal, New Jersey, which is also one of the most united, strong communities that has built itself up here in the U.S. And the thing is that it's a community, right? Like Syrian Jews are Syrian Jews, and we hold our community standard, and we're all, it's a one of us thing where we uplift each other. We have our own social welfare organizations. No one gets left behind. Every family stands up for each other. And, you know, the best way to explain this of what it means to have a community as opposed to just a diaspora is I have one of my best friends originally from Kenya, grew up in Jersey, went to NYU. We're very similar in a lot of ways. And she moved to Texas, to Austin, Texas, for a new job. And she said, look, my coworkers are older, don't really vibe with my roommate. How can I make friends here? What would you do? And I said, well, I guess like if I was in a new state, I would just like go to a shul or to a Chabad. And if there's no young people, everyone there knows a young person, and that would be like my starter group of friends. And she said, so you want me, a black woman, to walk into a church in Texas? And I said, I guess maybe it doesn't work the same for you, right?
Well, you can convert to Judaism.
You can convert to Judaism. But she ended up finding a group of African diaspora, which she was able to find a home in, right? So I think that the difference between just being a diaspora and being a community is having that understanding of, well, we are part of the same diaspora, we are linked, we're a community. The difference between, for example, the Indian diaspora and an Indian community would be that the diaspora could be everywhere, the community stands up for each other. So I think, like, how did I come to be, how did I come to stand for Jewish rights and all of that really comes into the fact that I was born and raised into two communities, the Mexican and the Syrian community, that taught me that we are all responsible for each other.
But I wanna focus on a word you used, and you may not even notice I used that word. And I think some people listening in would say, I don't understand this exactly. You said the risk of assimilation,
yes.
As if assimilation is a bad thing, a negative thing. A lot of people would say, wait, what's the risk of assimilation? I want to fit in. You just said a moment before that Jews being different makes Jews being a target. And now you're saying, but assimilation is the risky as well.
Yeah, so that's actually great and great catch there. I think that the risk of assimilation isn't assimilation itself. It's the risk of losing your Jewish identity. And it's also the risk of false comfort, right? Where you say, well, nothing can happen here. We're part of this. And you forget that you have that Jewish identity. I think, for example, in Mexico, as much as, you know, the Mexican community, they might not be the most religious, but they're very much traditional. So if you become part of your host country, and I call it host countries because, again, Jews are perpetual wanderers until we had our home, which is Israel. We're not home necessarily until we're in Israel. But when you're in your host country, it seems really great because you're a guest, but you always have that maybe I'm not. And when we overcompensate it, we lose our Jewish identity. And when you lose our Jewish identity, then what are you fighting for? And I actually have this competition.
I'm going to keep pushing.
Keep pushing because it's, yeah.
And partially because me being born and raised in Israel, like, I have very different experiences. Mm-hmm. Some Jews listening in that are all for, let's fight for Jewish civil rights, and some non-Jews would be like, wait, you just called the country you were born and raised in your host country, mm-hmm. rather than just your country. They would say that plays right into our detractors' hands. We're saying, look, you're not loyal to your country. You know, you keep speaking about Israel, and then yet Mexico or the United States or France or whoever, wherever you are, that's just your host country. And host also brings to mind parasite, right? Like the parasites of a thing to the host. So what do you mean when you say host country? Because you're very much Mexican, right?
Yes. Yes. So what I mean is that I haven't lost sight of that Jewish difference. Right. But I don't take it from a place of anxiety of I'm always going to be different. So I have to have this contingency plan of having somewhere else. So it's, for example, if you take Mexico, my grandma always says that we are beyond proud of being Mexican because Mexico help us become the family that we are today. They were taking in Jews 100%. They never put any sort of quota. The Jewish community was able to thrive. We were able to establish businesses. We were never bogged down. And Mexico is a Catholic country, right? Like, you would think that, you know, Jews coming into a Catholic country, it wouldn't work. But instead, we were able to thrive there and build a strong Jewish community. At the same time, we understand that we're the strong Jewish community. So we're proudly Mexican. We participate in Mexican life. You contribute to the country and you create your home, but you also don't want to get that sense of false comfort that I talked about before. And that's what I see happening a lot with the left in the United States. They've assimilated so much that they've become embarrassed of their Jewish identity to the point that the only way to be accepted is to hide it, and they're willing to compromise that for that kind of acceptance.
Why do you say it's just the left? I tend to see it all across the United States.
I think that the right is more accepting because they're accepting of communities of faith. I've been an interfaith podcaster back in the day, in a past life. Mm-hmm. I had an interfaith podcast with a Coptic Christian, and I'm a Syrian Jew. And we talked about all of that. And then at one point, BYU, Brigham Young University, reached out and had us on a interfaith podcasting panel. And I met other interfaith podcasters. And, you know, it wasn't like a right or left-leaning event. It's 0% politically affiliated. But the things that we were talking about, protecting religious liberties, just the words religious liberties, is kind of this whistle in your head of, well, is that a conservative talking point? Because in the left, religion has become a jest. It's become maybe an identity marker for a community. I'm culturally this, I'm culturally that. I was raised this. But religion itself is what's been lost. And it's a value that still exists on the right, which is why I don't see it on the right. On the right, you can keep your religious practice without being looked down upon. In fact, people will even see it as, wow, you're maintaining the values you were raised with. That's admirable. On the left, if you say something like, oh, I can't go out Friday night, I have synagogue, or, oh, no, I can't do brunch Sunday, I go to church, they kind of roll their eyes. And that's why you'll compromise your religion.
That is very interesting, because if you go back 50, 60 years to the African-American civil rights movement, it was very much rooted in religion. Now, not necessarily in dogma, but, you know, Martin Luther King was a pastor. You know, a lot of the power came from African American churches in the South, and people coming, you know, and you still see that. So why is it the case that for some minorities it's not as split, but for the Jewish minority it seems like it's more of a left-right thing?
It's a good question, and I'm not really sure. I'd say part of it has to do with academia, unless you're in theological studies, but even then, just religion seems to be against the modern form of academia, what ideas are desirable. They study religion scientifically, which you obviously can't do. And that point, anyone who's educated and part of the world has to look down on religion to be educated and part of the world.
See, it's very interesting, because I've never thought about it as like this freedom of religion is a right thing. Like, because I've in my mind, I always hear it as freedom of and from religion. So it takes both sides. Like, you know, part of being in the United States is that you're free to be whatever religion you want, and you're also free to not have a religion. And that should say nothing about who you are and what your community is.
100%. 100%. I think that the issue is that when you're part of a community of faith, and that's being looked at as being less than being part of another community, your typical kid that wants to be accepted, right? They want to be part of the world, will leave that behind. And they'll see as like, oh yeah, well, I was raised Jewish, or I was raised Catholic, I was raised Protestant, but I don't really practice.
So you're part of a strong community.
Yes.
First of Mexican Jews in Mexico City, yes. Then of Syrian Jews in Deal, New Jersey.
Yes.
Growing up, before you got to college, which we'll get to that in a second, have you experienced any anti-Semitism or being othered for being Jewish?
No, you know what? Because as international as I'd like to think I am, right? Born in Mexico, I have family in Brazil, Monaco, London, Montreal. I'm everywhere and nowhere all at once.
I have to ask.
Sao Paulo.
I have family in Sao Paulo
okay,
as well.
We'll okay. connect about this.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're friends. But as international as I am, I really only knew one community, which was the Syrian Jewish community. And then I got to Deal, which was the Syrian Jewish community, and I went to a Syrian Jewish school. So I didn't really interact that much with the non-Syrian world. In my head, it was even one of those things where it's like, well, if it's Saturday, why are there cars on the street? Like, I don't get it. Like, I knew, oh, like, well, there's non-Jews that are dry. Nothing really fit. And my family drives on Shabbat, but it was just like one of those things where it was like, but other families don't, so why are there cars? Because I was a child. I was a child, and that's just how I saw the world. The only time I felt othered, and it wasn't an anti-Semitism kind of thing, it wasn't discrimination, was my mom put me in the cheerleading program. And I love cheerleading. It wasn't part of my yeshiva high school or my yeshiva elementary or middle school. My cheerleading was part of the county, right? And that meant that there were games on Friday nights and Saturday mornings. So they would put me in the back of dances in a way where I could be easily taken out or in case they had a Friday or Saturday game instead of a Sunday game. You know, it wouldn't mess up the routine. And that was like the only time I felt like my Judaism was keeping me from a space I wanted to be in. But it wasn't because of discrimination. It was because of lack of accommodation. And we'll definitely get to this. It was one of the first steps in realizing the difference between something that's built for Jews and built to accommodate for Jews, like, for example, NYU versus YU or the United States versus the State of Israel.
But I don't necessarily understand the distinction between discrimination and lack of accommodation. And, I mean, obviously, definitionally, logically, I completely understand what you're saying. But no other minority in the United States would make this distinction. When a building is not accommodating for someone with a physical disability, a physical challenge, we say that the business in that building is discriminating. When any group, if it's a racial group, if it's gender identity, are not accommodated, we say that they are discriminated against. Why make that distinction when we're talking about Jewish civil rights?
So I think it's not just about Jewish civil rights. I think it's one of those things where, because it's a community-based program, it's like I'm all for the fight for equality. And I'm sure that if we filed some sort of case, you know, but it's the equivalent of saying, well, you know, my religious beliefs keep me from eating meat, and I went on an airline that didn't have a vegetarian option. But even if they did have a vegetarian option, I went on an airline that didn't have a specifically hekshered halal or kosher option. And it's one of those things of, well, what is the right that is owed to me? So weirdly enough, you know, if we're talking legally, this program was community funded, right? So technically, because there's a taxpayer stake, there is a right owed to the taxpayer. So there we could have had a case where it says, well, you should have to accommodate for all of the students that partake in this. But when it comes to, for example, like certain businesses, you can't walk into a restaurant and be upset that the food's not kosher. Right? It's not because they're discriminating against Jews, but it's because what they're providing is a certain thing, and you don't have a claim of right for them to provide something else, as opposed to, for example, service.
Let me push a little bit back on that, which is, first of all, you should know about me. I follow the law, I follow the rules, but I could care less about the rules. I don't care about the legal authority. I don't care about halacha authority.
I'm a lawyer, sir.
I know. I care about moral authority. Mm-hmm. And yes, maybe there is a case, maybe there isn't a case. But a middle schooler who wants to be part of her cheerleading troupe and cannot be because they are doing everything on Saturday and not on a weekday or on Sunday, to me, that's infringing on that middle schooler's Jewish civil rights.
Yeah, and again, I'm sure that if we would have had a conversation, like forget the fact that we could have had a legal claim. I'm sure if we had the conversation, they would have maybe organized the league to be a little bit different. But end of the day, like I remember they had like a annual dinner at the end of the season. It was always on a Friday night. It's these things. Yes, we could have had that kind of fight. But when you really look at the numbers, if we try to accommodate for every population, it wouldn't be feasible, right?
But let me tell you like a story that happened at my university. Mm-hmm. This past year, you know, at Columbia University, there were the illegal encampments. They took over, violently took over a building. And then the university said, because they knew there's going to be a lot of things during graduation, they, instead of dealing with the problem, they said, let's cancel graduation, right? Very typical of bureaucrats that have no spine. But so they canceled the main graduation, and each school had its own ceremony. Now, because they couldn't do it in the main campus, which is where they typically do in Morningside Heights, each school had to go somewhere else. Columbia Business School decided to have its graduation in Baker Fields. Mm-hmm. Baker Fields is at 218th Street in New York. It happens to be the case that I know of at least one student, an MBA student, someone who paid over $100,000 to attend Columbia, was graduating. He's an Orthodox Jew. And because it was in 218th Street rather than 116th Street, and because it was on Saturday, on Shabbat, he could not attend his own graduation. Mm-hmm. When some Jewish students ask, why is it being done on Saturday rather than Sunday, they were told, we cannot accommodate everyone, and Sunday is Mother's Day. So it's about priorities.
Yeah.
They did not want to disrupt Mother's Day. So they were okay with throwing some Jews under the bus. I don't know if any other minority group is doing the same mental calculations that you and I are doing of, oh, but if they do this, then they'll have to do that. Most groups stand up and say, hey, I want to be counted, period. You, whoever the you is, you the institution, you the organization, you have a problem. You have to figure it out. Make five ceremonies. I don't care. But why should I be paying the price?
Yeah. No, and you're right. And that's actually the legal activism side of things. So there's always going to be two sides. And I talk about this a lot, especially to younger students. There's activism and advocacy. And there's a difference between the two. Activism is about the top down. Sorry, the bottom up. Activism is about coming in from the bottom. You are not looking to compromise. You are making as much noise as you can. You are asking for a mile and you want a mile. And advocacy is different. You identify the change makers and you come in top down, looking already to compromise, knowing that you're advocating for a mile in order to get an inch. And it's different levels of getting to where you need to be. So when it comes to for example, like what I do, when it comes to activism, yes, we have to say, we have to stand up and we have to say, well, why is every other group not doing the mental gymnastics? Why have we been kept out of so many other spaces? And that's the activism approach, which is very necessary. But when you come from the advocacy approach, especially the legal approach, you have to understand that everything is a drop in the bucket. And at some point, the bucket will become heavy enough to tip with the help of the activists coming in from the bottom up. And it's going to meet in the middle. But you have to start putting in those drops. And the way that you start is by, for example, with that law school, with that graduation, the MBA graduation, by start making noise. And the best thing that you could have done there was file a complaint with the school because you start creating the paper trail. Because that itself might not be cause for a case, but once you start creating that paper trail, it's all these little drops to the point that when the students do turn around and they want to say, well, Columbia has been systematically discriminating against Jews, you have the record of a complaint being made about that specific issue. And that's one of the things that set my case apart, and I'm sure that we'll get to that from the others, was the paper trail. So it's you're right. We shouldn't stand for any injustice, no matter how small. But with the small injustices, let's start filing those complaints. Let's start really documenting them. And that way, you'll actually have something bigger.
So where do you stand on the advocate activist spectrum?
So I am a born advocate. I've always been a student government kid. I was president of my middle school. I was in student government in high school, student government in college. I just finished law school. Guess where I was? Student government. I'm always a student government kid. I've always
been
the one.
You're like the mirror image of me. I am always been the one in the outside screaming, this is
you're the table
fair.
Flipper. You're like, I want to flip the table. And I'm like, no, flippers. I want to sit at the table.
But yes. We had this exchange in November when we met. We were on a panel together.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that there are people like you because I could never be an advocate.
Yeah. And I'm glad there's people like you because I had to become an activist. Now I am an activist. Now I'm on social media and I make videos and I do this and I make the noise that I can and I'll go to protests and rallies, but that's not innately in me. I had to become the activist. Actually, like, again, we'll get to it. But when I was at NYU, I told the administration.
So let's get to NYU.
Let's get to NYU.
That's the thing that's sitting there. So you get to NYU.
Yes.
And you continue being an advocate. You become the head of Realizing Israel.
Yeah.
What is Realizing Israel?
So Realize Israel is the student group that's pro-Israel at NYU. It started around the same time that SSI chapters started coming up, but we made our own. And the name Realize Israel really has two.
We, meaning you started it?
No, it was started by, oh, okay. It was started about 3 months before I came into college.
Okay.
My brother was one of the, you know, founding group. And the way that it came to be was in the spring of 2015, there was a very large apartheid week at NYU. And the Jewish students...
For people that don't know what is
apartheid week. For people who don't know that what apartheid week is. So if you've seen college campuses, usually there's one week in the spring where across college campuses, usually it's the same week, Students for Justice in Palestine, along with whatever allies they have, create either a fake wall or a fake demonstration or a fake die-in talking about how Israel is apartheid, raising awareness about the apartheid in Israel against Palestinians. And usually it's not even like, you know, sprinkled with lies. Usually it's overt lies about the number of babies that Israelis kill and how they take pleasure in killing them. It's really something that's misinformation propaganda to the nth degree that tugs on people's heartstrings.
And this has been happening for years. Like
for
most,
years.
Most people have tuned into the college campuses in the past year, seeing the anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. But the framework, the foot soldiers, the work has been done already for years in these apartheid weeks.
Okay. For years and years and years. And Students for Justice in Palestine, the group behind it, they're extremely organized. If you read their handbook for their national chapters, their winter semester, the fall semester, is all about planning. It's a dormant semester where essentially if you're a board member, your job is to join other clubs and befriend members of their board. You have to befriend two people on their executive board. And then when you hop into your spring semester, you already have the BDS resolution drafted and you've already been working on those coalitions. So now suddenly if you started with the Students for Justice in Palestine that had maybe 10 members, you suddenly have 20 clubs that are backing you. And that's how these things snowball, because they are so organized and mechanical about this, and they already have the apartheid week planned every single week for the same years. Like right every year, the same week, they already have that ready, and they start recruiting people from the fall without those students realizing they're being recruited. So this has been in motion for years, and it's only gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's why I was 0% surprised to watch the campuses cave after October 7th.
So we get to realize Israel.
So realize Israel. So the way it formed was a group of Jewish students saw apartheid week. It was bigger that year than other years. And they went first to the campus Hillel and they said, well, can you do something? And they said, no, we don't get involved in these kinds of things. And they went to the Chabad and the Chabad said, no, we don't get involved in these kinds of things, but we support you. We don't really get involved. And then the student said, great. So it was actually a group of AAPI guys and another just Jewish kids at NYU that got whatever Israeli flags they had in their dorm rooms. And they just stood outside singing Hatikva. And they made a big sign about, Israel and Judaism saying, you know, like Zionism is a right. And they kept that going. My brother was a senior at NYU. They kept that going for all of apartheid week, pretty much. So by the time I came in as a freshman that fall, realized Israel was this budding group where Jewish students had said, it's time to take action. We'll take this onto our own hands. And they did. And, it's funny because you always say, well, where did I get this from? I always had my strong Jewish identity, but I was always like the human rights kid, right? I wanted to be a human rights advocate. My goal going into college was to work at the United Nations and fight human trafficking in Latin America. That was an issue I saw prevalent. My family left Mexico actually because of the rise of kidnappings in Mexico in the late 90s. And my family said, after a couple of attempted kidnappings of my brother, they said, we're leaving. We need to go somewhere else. And we went to the United States. And we found solace in the law and order and the protection of the U.S. And that's why I'm very proud to be a U.S. resident. I wish I was a citizen, but I'm a resident and I'll continue to fight for America. That's my whole thing. But I said, great, I'm going to fight human trafficking in Latin America so no one's going to have to worry about human trafficking. And when I got to campus, I, you know, didn't want to be involved in the Jewish things. I said, Judaism's great, part of who I am, don't want to be the Jewish girl. Didn't stay in the Jewish dorm. You know, I had a radio talk show with WNYU Radio. I joined student government, as I do. And I didn't really want to be involved in the Jew things until one day I was walking through Washington Square.
Why?
Why?
Because why did you not
I went to yeshiva day school my entire life, elementary, middle, high school. And Syrian Jews are great. And they, again, I owe everything I am to the Syrian Jewish community. But they're very close-minded in a lot of ways. And I was ready to just get to college and just be a person.
Was there a part of you that wanted to assimilate?
Yeah, look at that. It wasn't really assimilated. It's I just wanted to meet people who weren't like me.
Okay.
And I felt that if I didn't put myself in those circles, or if I gave myself the security blanket of, well, I'm staying in the Jewish dorm, then I'm not putting myself in that position where I meet people who aren't like me. So I did that. And then I walked through Washington Square one day, and there was a group of Jewish students holding Israeli flags. And, you know, I didn't know anyone really. So they gave out Israeli flags, and I took one. And they got into a circle, and I got in the circle with them. And they started talking about bus bombings that happened that week in Israel. October 2015. There was one almost every 2 weeks. And they talked about one specifically that got to me, where Ezra Schwartz, who was my age, doing a gap year in Israel, lost his life. And that's something I could have been doing, because when I applied to NYU, it was my only choice. I wanted to go to NYU. I had no backups. My backup was, if I don't get in, I'll go to Israel for the year, and then I'll come back and apply. That was my whole goal and dream. Mm-hmm. Of course, I got into NYU, so happy. But to think someone that really could have been me, that could have been doing the same thing I would have been doing in that moment had I not gotten into NYU, that's kind of what did it for me. And I stood with these strangers holding my Israeli flag, singing Hatikva, saying, how did I go from a yeshiva day school to not knowing this even happened? I'm not going to look for a cause to fight for if I already have my own, and I have to start at home. So I joined Realize Israel, and by the end of my freshman year, I became the vice president.
I want to keep talking about that, but you just said something that really is so fascinating. Why should I look for a cause if it's not my own, when I already have one? But it seems like so many Jewish people in diaspora, especially in the United States, for decades, did exactly that.
Yeah.
Why? Why is it so hard for us to stand up and say, you know what? This is our cause, Jewish civil right. That doesn't mean that other causes are not important. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean we won't march with them, but we will organize our fight. Why do you think that's so hard for so many Jews?
So that's the root of the issue. That's why I'm the whole stay and fight for the diaspora. That's my whole ideology, because I want to understand, why does it come to that question? Why won't we stand up for ourselves, but we'll stand up for others? I think, on one hand, like, this is a funny anecdote, I'm really bad at advocating for myself, which is funny, right? I sued NYU, I did a whole thing, and of course we're going to talk about that. And everyone sees me as like, wow, like, you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to fight, you're going to do these things. I worked at the district attorney for all my internships in law school, except for one. And really, like, I fight for justice. That's my whole thing. But if I get the wrong order at the restaurant, like, they bring the salad with bacon, I'd rather get the salad to go and give it to someone else than say, hey, I actually ordered it without bacon. Because I don't know how to do that. And I think part of it's psychological. I think that the only reason I can get to the reason why Jews won't stand up for themselves is twofold. Either one, because of the innate justice value that Jews have of fighting for others and, you know, making the world better, and tikkun olam, like, maybe it's that. But I didn't really grow up with, like, the tikkun olam mindset. We're Syrians. We look out for our own, right? Like, we're not tikkun olaming. We're looking out for our own. I think it's really, it comes from the ingrained, if there's danger, I should flee. And it's kind of like, the fight's not worth having because we could just go somewhere else. We could just go somewhere else. We could just go somewhere else. Look at me. When people ask me where I'm from and I say Mexico, they just say, no, you're not, right? And they say, where are you really from? And I say Syria and Lebanon. And then they still look at me and they say, no, where are you really from? And I say, well, I guess I'm just Jewish, right? And it's like, why do we have to keep finding somewhere else to go that shouldn't be our default response? Fight or flight, and we always choose flight? That shouldn't be it. So I'm trying to change that within myself. Yeah. I'm trying to be a better advocate, not just for the Jewish people, but also for myself as an individual. You know, tell that restaurant, I got the salad with that bacon. I wish I could tell you why, but you're right. You're right. When it comes to fighting for causes, Jews are fighting for every cause, and it seems like we're forgetting our own, and I don't know why.
So you get so you walk through Washington Square Park, you get a flag, you stand there, you have this moment of, I wouldn't call it an epiphany, because you've, it's a reawakening of something that's already inside of you.
Yeah.
Then what?
Then I joined Realize Israel. And for 2 years, everything was great at NYU. By the end of my sophomore year, I was the president. And it was great. I mean, we
shocking,
had it.
Surprising. Shocking. Yeah.
What? But I was also on student government. And I was still doing everything else I was doing. I became vice president of my sorority. You know, I was doing a lot of Adela things, right? A lot of on-brand things for me. But ultimately, we had an SJP. We had a JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace. They're the Jewish equivalent of SJP. They're usually about 3 or 4 Jews that don't understand their own identity, I'd like to say. And I have my theories behind it, which we can get into. But it was relatively small. They kept to themselves. We kept to ourselves. During apartheid week, they did their thing. We went to the other side of the street and did our thing. But we never had really any true clashes until my junior year. And my junior spring, suddenly that whole semester turned to Israel-Palestine. All of it.
What happened that year?
So it started with a statement that came out by the Minority Student Association, the Governance Council of Minority and Marginalized Students, that puts Zionism in the same category as racism and Nazism. And when I saw that come out, you know, it's a student government statement, I responded to my friends on student government. I had been on student government for a semester already, doing good work with them. And I said, hey, I saw the statement. Can we talk about it? And they said, no, well, because we don't talk to fascists.
What? Okay, but why did it bother you? They didn't say Judaism or Jewishness. They said Zionism.
They said Zionism.
Why did that bother you so much?
I think that putting Zionism in the same category as Nazism is offensive to the Jewish community at large. Especially when, you know, not my family, but when the majority of Jewish students at NYU, which are Ashkenaz, have Holocaust survivors in their family, their own grandparents, to have Nazism be placed in the same sentence as the movement for Jewish self-determination and the Jewish right to a homeland, that wouldn't stand with me at all. And I didn't come at them with an attack. I said, hey, I saw this statement that came out. Can we talk about it?
Let's have a conversation.
And again, they said, we will not engage with fascists. And that was the first time that my Zionism kept me from a space I was previously welcomed in.
And then what?
So I got the Jewish community together, and of the Jewish clubs, of course, minus SJP and J Street, the other 15 Jewish clubs got together and wrote a statement that wasn't angry and calling anyone out, but it was disappointed that the minority student council couldn't understand why Zionism and Nazism don't belong in the same category.
And why didn't J Street? I know why JVP didn't join you, but why didn't J Street? J Street is supposedly a two-state solution, peaceful, we're democratic, we're still Jewish, we're, you know, why didn't they support you?
J Street was two students who meant very well, who JVP was kind of pulling, but they felt in their hearts that JVP wasn't their place, so they started J Street, and they just didn't want to rock the boat, which I understand, and I'm not going to hold it against those two students. But ultimately, the night before we were going to put out the statement, and I feel like you're going to enjoy this anecdote, I got a call from a mentor of mine who worked for the university for years. Jewish mentor, built a strong career long before I was born. And he said, I hear you're putting out a statement. And I said, I am. And he said, well, are you sure you want to do that? I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, if the narrative is that, you know, Jewish students are against minorities, why would you put out a statement against the minority communities? You're playing into their power narrative. Who even read the email? Who reads student government emails other than you? If you draw attention to the issue, you're just making it bigger. And if you ignore it, it'll go away. And I thought about this. And remember, I was president of Realize Israel, and I was also the representative of Jewish students on student government. So it really came down to me. And I made the decision against the wishes of the Jewish community of NYU not to publish. Until this day, it's my biggest regret, but it's not something I do differently, and I'll tell you why.
It sounds like that person would get a phone call from a woman saying, you know, my partner is abusing me, he's beating me up, I want to go and tell the cops, I want to do something. It was like, well, don't do that. If you do it, it'll get worse.
You'll
anger him. Mm-hmm. You'll just draw attention.
Yep.
You know, he actually loves you. Mm-hmm. It's just a misunderstanding. What the fuck?
Yeah. I agree. And the worst is later on when I went on to make it an even bigger deal, you know, I spoke to them again and they said, well, how dare you say NYU has a problem with anti-Semitism? We have a campus in Tel Aviv and we have, you know, a kosher dining hall.
Some of my best friends are Jewish.
Yeah. For me, that's like, oh yeah, he beats you, he buys you purses, right? Like that's not really, the issue is conduct. The issue is conduct. But ultimately, I made the decision, which is one of my weaker moments, and I talk about it whenever I talk to students, that I really highlight this, and I made the decision not to publish it. And we didn't publish. I did meet with the school, and they said, what do you want us to do about this? And I said, put it on your radar because I feel something bigger is coming. And we didn't publish, but in the next 3 months, NYU became one of the most anti-Semitic campuses in the United States. Because 2 weeks after that we didn't publish the statement to stand up for ourselves, we had a BDS resolution on NYU student government. 2 weeks after that, we had professors pledging to boycott all Israeli academics. And 2 weeks after that, we had 53 groups, which is one in every six at NYU, pledging to boycott not only the state of Israel, but Realize Israel and any group that would partner with us. So within a month and a half, we didn't stand up for ourselves after that first mention, but Jewish students are boycotted against, you know, in the student group arena. Academics, you're walking into your class knowing your professor is boycotting Israeli academics, and now your student government wants to boycott NYU Tel Aviv. So it was kind of like the snowball moment, and I met with the administration every single week pretty much, and they sent me on a wild goose chase from one department to another to meet with every single administrator, and I kept saying, I feel something big is coming. And I kept saying it, and I kept saying it, and I kept saying it with every administrator I met with. And leading up to Yom HaAtzma'ut, usually we rent out Washington Square, and we throw a massive Yom HaAtzma'ut celebration. And we had been doing this for three years. That would be the fourth one that we were going to have. Realize Israel, rave in the park. It's fun. Be there, be square. And that year, I knew would be different. So I reached out to the school, and I said I was worried for student safety. Now, so you understand this event, usually the park fills with 300 Jewish students wrapped in Israeli flags. My mom comes every year, and remember, we're Syrian and Mexican. So when my mom saw for the first time Jewish students wrapped in Israeli flags in the middle of New York City singing Hatikva, she said, this is Judaism in the 21st century. This is beautiful. This is Jewish pride in its purest form. Not Jewish pride in Israel, where we're in Israel. This is Jewish pride in the United States, out in the open, wearing your Israeli flag, saying, I'm Jewish and I'm not afraid. That's beautiful. I'm Jewish and I'm united with my brothers. That's beautiful. And that year I knew would be different. And the way the event kicked off was with an anti-Israel student coming to the center of the protest line, because a protest did amass, massive protest, almost the size of the rave, with an Israeli flag in hand, just lit it on fire, threw it on the ground, and let it burn. Then another student, who was actually in multiple classes with me, came to the center in that moment where we sing Hatikva. Usually you feel the trees are even vibrating with energy. You feel this, I can't tell you what it usually feels like. But that year, he came to the center, grabbed a microphone from the Jewish girl, started shoving her, yelling, free, free Palestine. And then at that point, NYPD stepped in. They made two arrests.
I want to stop for a second. What is this rave in the park for? You know, are you saying anything about Palestinians?
Nope.
Are you saying anything about war?
We fly in a DJ. We have Bamba. We play Israeli music with Israeli flags, and anyone walking through Washington Square can join. I can send you some beautiful.
So let's say it's
like a block party.
I'm not Jewish. Maybe I'm even like on this Israeli Palestinian. I don't exactly know where I am, but I'm more on. I care about the civilians in Gaza, as I actually do, and we all should. But let's say I'm really concerned. Can I join this party?
100%. Come through. Anyone can come through.
So what was their problem? Why would they burn your flag? Why would they take the mic? What's the issue?
Because we're Zionists. They were chanting, no Zionists at NYU. Because for them, fundamentally,
back then,
the state of Israel,
2019,
this is 2018. For them, fundamentally, the state of Israel does not have a right to exist at all. End point, period. So when we wave Israeli flags to them, that's just unheard of. Unheard of. And when he came and assaulted the girl, grabbed the microphone, when NYPD stepped in and pulled him out, they had taken our other Israeli flags, torn them to shreds, and hung them from trees and lampposts. So if you were a Jewish student, you had watched your flag burn, get hung from trees, and a Jewish girl assaulted and battered. NYPD stepped in and made arrests. And then I went back to the school. And I said, at this point, there's been physical violent action taken against the community.
I believe they only arrested two people.
They only arrested two. Yeah. They only arrested two.
NYPD did the absolute minimum that they needed to, but not the maximum to actually keep Jewish students safe.
But look, end of the day, there's
I know
the
you're a lawyer.
I know.
I'm talking
for the
as
DA,
an activist. So you're talking as an advocate.
Yes. So again, like end of the day, it came down to the conduct and the violent, the physical actions that were taken. They arrested the student that burned the flag. They arrested the student that assaulted the girl.
Right. So you arrest the person shooting the Jew, not the hundred people shouting Zig Heil.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you go back to the school.
Went back to the school, and I said, look, at this point, I'm not imagining non-existing threats. There's been violent physical action taken against my community. And they essentially said, yes, you're right. A line's been crossed. We're going to take action, but behind the scenes. And I said, what do you mean behind the scenes? And they said, well, we don't want the narrative to be that NYU is against, certain minority communities. So don't worry, we'll do what has to be done, but behind the scenes. And I, in another moment
I'm
of
I'm sorry,
weakness,
I got to stop
yeah,
you again
I
because
know.
I don't understand. So let's say a Korean student organization complains about, no, let's say the Taiwanese student organization complains about the Chinese student organization that they did something, they shredded the Taiwanese flag because there's tensions between the countries. And the Taiwanese student organization would come to NYU and said, look, this Chinese student organization, we have nothing against them, but this is what they did.
Yeah.
So NYU would say, no, we don't want to offend any other minority group. Is that the argument? It's okay that we're attacking one minority group. Let's not offend the other.
So I actually want to stay on the flag burning point with you because this is something I talk about a lot. Flag burning, right? Freedom of speech, sure. But a couple of things. I'm Mexican. I'm not a U.S. citizen. If someone would have burned a Mexican flag at NYU and said, no, I'm not against Mexicans. I'm against immigration. This is a political stance. They can burn the flag, sure.
They could.
But are you telling me NYU isn't making a statement about it?
Oh, that student would be home, you know, by the end of the day. You know, they would be, at least they would be suspended.
Oh, but they're just expressing political views. They're just expressing political views.
But they would
views.
Say the political mm-hmm. views do not reflect our university, our
exactly.
community.
Or at least put out a statement.
Yes.
NYU did nothing. And then that's if we're talking politics. Let's talk identity, because I identified as a Zionist. I had no reason to identify as a Zionist. I decided I'm a Zionist. Sure, if someone were to burn an LGBTQ flag, NYU would make a statement, LGBTQ is an identity. And then if you want to take all politics out of it, remember I said I was vice president of my sorority? Great, I come from Greek life. I know Greek life. If two fraternities are in Washington Square Park, one grabs the flag of the other fraternity, burns it, and then they assault one of the other fraternity members, you're telling me that fraternity isn't being suspended? So why is it when it comes to flag burnings, the only flag you can burn, and it becomes not only not alarming, but celebrated, is my flag? And that's the reason why I decided to actually take action. So let me walk you through what ended up happening. Yeah. Because I sat in the office, he said he'll take action, but he'll do it behind
the scenes.
The vice president of NYU, of student affairs. And again, against the wishes of the Jewish community, I said I would trust the school. I was being naive. But again, I wouldn't do it differently. Because guess what? A year later, one calendar year, less than a calendar year, I had left the Middle Eastern Studies Department. I had left my positions on student government. I just wanted to graduate because I didn't want to be involved anymore. And NYU releases the nominees and
the
awardees.
Before we get to
that
is a shocker. And
it is a shocker. And actually,
I want to
create
suspension for the people listening.
Great.
Tune in. No, but you just said something. You left your your major?
Yeah, so I was in NYU Gallatin, which is a school of individualized study, which essentially means that NYU opens all of its schools to Gallatin students, and we build our own major, which was really great. And what was my major? I love talking about it. Gallatin students, you might have seen some videos about them on TikTok, because everyone has a made-up major that's a sentence. It's not a word, it's a sentence. I majored in Middle Eastern diaspora structures, maintaining difference and seeking acceptance, which is pretty much what we've been talking about here.
Okay.
So it's quite literally my major.
And then you dropped the Middle Eastern.
Yeah, so pretty much in it.
Why did you drop the Middle Eastern?
I'll tell you.
Israel is in the Middle East.
It is in the Middle East. But in my classes, I forget that I was boycotted in student government. You know, everywhere I went, I was the Zionist. I'd walk into a room and like the Regina George Mean Girls moment where everyone's whispering and they go, that's the Zionist. Yeah, so I had that moment every time I walked into a classroom. It got to the point that my classmates in my Arabic class wouldn't partner with me for final projects. My professors themselves said that it might be better if I stopped coming to class. And I was grateful to them. I said, wow, they're so kind. They're so kind that they're allowing me not to come into class because I'm being harassed. Insanity.
Insanity.
They actually arranged for me to take my final exams in a separate room. And there was an uninvolved girl. Uninvolved. Sweet, sweet, random, uninvolved black girl who decided to partner with me for a project. She started feeling so uncomfortable in the class that she actually asked to take her final exams with me instead of the rest of the class. And I was grateful that they gave me the option to take my exams separately because of this weird internalization of, well, I don't deserve to claim space. And if my presence makes the class uncomfortable and I'm being harassed in class, it's better for the class if I'm not there.
You know, one thing that I'm trying to keep it together.
keep it together. Let it out.
You know, I'm doing this podcast about Jewish civil rights. I'm doing it because I am a strong, proud Jew, a strong, proud Israeli. But I'm also a strong, proud professor. And it doesn't matter who you are. NYU denied you the education that not only you deserve, that you earned, but that you paid for. Mm-hmm. That, if that doesn't, and I don't know if there's any professors that will be listening to this, but if that doesn't make every professor in the United States of America angry, and I don't care if you're Jewish, not Jewish, if you're anti-Zionist, I don't care who you are, you should immediately let your college know that you're leaving, because you are not a real professor. If you are not angered by the fact that a student cannot sit in their own class because of who they are.
100%. And it's also like a reciprocal situation where, for example, like if they're saying, well, the students aren't partnering with me because of my political views, right? My political view on Zionism. Granted, I was the only Jew in the class. And I can't imagine a situation where if you only have one student of color in the class who supports Black Lives Matter because they themselves are black, for example, and everyone says, well, we're not going to work with her because of her political views. You have the antennas and you say that's racism.
No, forget about that. Even if it's something as simple as a student, a conservative student in a school, a very liberal school, or a liberal student in a very conservative school, and people said, I don't want to work with them. That's the whole point of college. That you work with people that you don't agree with, that you work with people and you educate yourself, you might find out that that person is not the devil.
Mm-hmm. Louder for the people in the back. Really.
So we get to the, and I want to get the title right, the Presidential Service Award.
The President's Service Award.
Yeah, indeed. The President's Service Award. What's this? Tell me.
Yes, so pretty much when... Again, I'm in NYU. At this point, it's my senior year. I'm about 2 months out from graduation. It's February, so 3 months, maybe. And I get an email that NYU announces it will be giving the President's Service Award to Students for Justice in Palestine.
For their exemplary contributions to the NYU community.
Yep.
That's a direct quote from the email that they received.
That's a direct quote from the email.
Exemplary contributions to the NYU community. So yep. The organization that has been personally terrorizing you and your organization and the Jewish community is getting an award, which basically means that NYU is saying you're not part of the community.
Yep. And saying you want to know how to win an award at NYU. You pick a minority community, you protest all of their events, you burn their flag, assault their members, spend 2 years harassing them, and so long as that group is Jewish, we'll give you an award. That's what it told me in that moment. And again, at this point, I had left the Middle East Studies Department, I had left student government, I just wanted to graduate. I was taking classes in creative writing and dance just to get enough credits to get out of there.
That's not a bad thing, by the way. There's a lot of people that take classes.
My wife is a writer. My sister's a creative writing major at Princeton, and now she's doing her master's in publishing at NYU. My sister's a writer. My other sister, dancer. I am neither of the two.
Okay.
I wanted to be a Middle Eastern studies major, but I really just wanted to like be out of like the class where I'm walking in and I know that there's going to be a fight. I walked into the Art of Personal Essay and I said, great, I'm going to write an essay about my family. And I did. And it was so nice. Everything was so nice that semester up until that point. And when I saw the award, you know, my friends started texting me about it. And I was just like, oh, yeah, crazy. Oh, typical NYU giving awards to anti-Semites. Ha ha, yeah, I saw. Yeah, insane. I just really didn't care. And it wasn't until a friend called me and said, what are you going to do about it? And I said, no, I don't have to do anything. I gave my whole college experience to this. I am about to graduate. I'm on my way out. And I really felt it wasn't my responsibility. And the more we talked, my friend said, well, you know, can you at least get us a meeting with the vice president of NYU? And remember, I had met with him almost every week for like a year. So I was like, sure, I'm sure I can do that. So I tried to get a meeting. I called, no answer, email, no answer, call again, no answer. Secretary picks up, tells me he's too busy, tells me to call back. I call back, she says, no, he's too busy, don't call back. It went back and forth until I went to his office physically. She said he didn't have time.
This is the vice dean of student affairs.
Vice president of student affairs.
Vice president of student affairs.
So who, by the way, is Jewish.
The person who's supposed to have time for
student affairs.
Yes.
Of all the things. Okay. And the award came out of their office, a committee out of their office.
Yeah.
Don't put your contact information on an award you don't want to be contacted about. He essentially dodged me. I sat outside his door until he came out. And when he did, he said he just didn't have time to speak with me. And I said, please just give me a couple of minutes. It's a word in my community. He said, no, I'm too busy. I said, when can you meet with me? He said, first week of May. I looked at him. I said, it's
that
February.
Was his biggest mistake.
I said, first week of May. He said, yep. I said, you can't meet with me for 3 months? He said, no. And He looked at his secretary and said, first week of May. And I walked out of there dumbfounded. I said, what just happened? So I thought about it. That's really where I started thinking about everything that had gone on at NYU over the last 2 years. Started thinking about every meeting I had with him where he did nothing. And that's really where I started thinking. I have been in his office looking to make a change. But he'll only listen to noise. And if he only listens to noise, I'm going to have to make it. So I got in touch with lawyers.
That's when you became an activist.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
That was my turning point. It was really just walking out of that meeting that it became a turning point for me. Because I had lawyers reach out to me saying, you know, after the flag burning a year before, they said, hey, you know, you might have a case. So, you know, let us know if you're interested. And I was like, no, NYU said that they're going to fix it. And they said they're going to take actions behind the scenes. But NYU is going to change things. He told me he loved me. He told me he loved me.
Yeah.
He told me it'll be different from here on out.
Yeah.
So I got back in touch with them. And I asked if I had a case. And they explained to me outright that Title VI of the Civil Rights Act at the time only protected nationality, ethnicity, and race, not religion. So they said, you need to understand that your case will not have legal teeth. And I said, let me send you all the documents I have, and we'll talk about it. And I sent them over 70 pages of documents. We're talking emails, pictures, screenshots, videos, everything I had. And they called me back within the day to tell me this is the strongest case we've seen.
And you weren't a pre-law student.
Nope.
You're just a pissed off Jew.
A pissed off Jew.
Okay.
I guess, you know.
Very brilliant, by the way. Oh. I mean, one of the things that I've been telling people is keep a paper trail of everything. If someone tells you mm-hmm. something, email them back saying, just to make sure this is what you said. So mm-hmm. you have that in writing so that 5 years down, when you get fired, you have that.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you send the paper trail. They tell you it's the strongest case.
Mm-hmm.
But you just told me that Title VI doesn't cover yep. religion. What's the case?
So they told me that my case could essentially make a difference in the way that the United States analyzes Title VI discrimination. And again, they said, legally, you're going to lose, but this is the first step. This is the foot in the door, and your goal is going to be publicity, which, funny enough, was my goal in the first place, right? I wanted to finally make that noise. So I decide to go forward with it and to file my Title VI case against NYU, something that had been done for anti-Semitism only once before against Rutgers, and it wasn't really a case that got anywhere.
So you're telling me that the first time that a real case, Title VI case against anti-Semitism against the university was in 2019.
Yeah. We had the 2016 case against Rutgers. But
so that's because there's never been anti-Semitism in U.S. colleges? Is that why?
So it's a great question. And this actually takes me back to a conversation I had with Ken Marcus. Ken Marcus is the founder of the Brandeis Center. And when he, you know, long before I sued NYU, I happened to be able to hear him speak at an event. And he had just been, you know, appointed by the Trump administration to be the head of the Office of Civil Rights. And someone raised their hand and said, well, now that you're in the Office of Civil Rights, why am I still seeing discrimination on college campuses against Jewish students? I'm still reading about anti-Semitic attacks. And he said, you are 100% right. Every time there's an anti-Semitic attack on a campus, I read about it on my computer and I get so upset. And that's it. Because I sit at my desk and a complaint never comes. Mm. And if the complaint doesn't come, I cannot act. And I heard this in maybe 2017. I am so lucky I was there to hear it. Because that was really the turning point for me.
That's, I think, something that I want to emphasize for whoever will be listening to this. If a complaint doesn't come, they cannot act.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you filed a complaint.
Yeah, so we decided that we were going to do it. Oh, this is going to be a fun, juicy story. So we decided we're going to do it behind the scenes. And I decided to go through with it. We compile all my paperwork. They draft a complaint. They give me a team of lawyers. Everyone's doing everything pro bono. We're not suing for money at all. There are no damages. The only thing that we're doing is filing a Title VI complaint for NYU to include anti-Semitism in their existing discrimination policy. Because it wasn't there, which is insane. So it's literally the floor. It was a foot in the door case. And we start getting to work on everything. And we decided that everything was going to go to press in April. And after that, it was just going to be a summer of speaking tour, essentially, for me to get as much word out there as I possibly can. The night before our lawsuit went public, I decided to get in touch with my mentor that called me the year before to tell me not to file, you know, not to publish that statement mm-hmm. against SJP. And I said, this is a courtesy call. Just wanted to let you know. I moved forward with the Title VI case. I actually filed it 2 months ago, so it's already in the works. But tomorrow it'll go public. Again, it's a courtesy call, so you're not blindsided.
Why are you giving them a courtesy call?
Because I knew he'd have to deal with a lot of fallout.
So what? You had to deal with fallout for 4 years. Why did you do that?
I'm sure. I don't know. I felt it was the right thing to do. And like I expected, I start getting the, what have you just done? You don't even know what you just did. You just set off a nuclear bomb, and you're not even going to be here because you're going to graduate, and you're not even going to see it explode. And, you know, Jewish students, like, we're so safe here. How dare you say NYU has an anti-Semitism problem? Going on and on and on and on, saying, you know, this is going to cause so much more problems. You're drawing attention to this. You're just going to make it so much bigger. You know, they're going to say that we're complainers or this. And I started crying because I was a 21-year-old child. And, you know, when I hung up the phone.
It sounds like you, like that person was the child, and
yeah,
you were the adult
in
the room.
I agree. But when I hung up, I called my brother and I said, I regret filing this case. What did I do? What have I done? And he said, no, we did it this way for a reason. He said, you'll see, everything comes around. And essentially my case goes to press the next day. I get a call from the vice president of NYU to my cell. He said, hey, Adele, I'm reading some articles here about
You sure they have a title six only in May?
Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm reading some Title VI case here, some anti-Semitism thing. Can you come into my office? And I straight up said, ooh, I'm much too busy. About the first week of May, and when I came
good
the first
for
week
you.
Of May, thank you. It was a good moment for me. It was a good moment for me because when I did show up in May, I wasn't in the same headspace I was in February of saying this award. You know, my community, like who was on the committee, like you know SJP, they spent so much time harassing us, like. I didn't come in with that headspace, that victim, can you explain what happened? No. I came with my calendar and I said, here's every time I met with you over the last 2 years. And because you didn't take a single action against anti-Semitism, you're going to have to deal with a Title VI lawsuit. And I said, again, I've never been the activist. But again, I'm going to make the noise and the headline will read, Jewish student sues NYU for anti-Semitism. And that's exactly the headline that he read that morning. It was everything that was supposed to happen. And I was a week and a half from graduation, 2 weeks from graduation. So it wasn't my problem anymore. That's it. I filed my case. I set off the bomb. And yeah, I got to graduate right after. Thank God they gave me my diploma. And I spent the next 3 months making publicity for my case, as was the plan, until, shall I get to the meat of it?
Yes.
Okay. Until one day in December, I get a call from a restricted Washington, D.C. number. And I pick it up, random Tuesday, and they say, hi, we're calling you from the White House. And they tell me that the president at the time, President Trump, heard about my case and that he thinks anti-Semitism is a big problem on college campuses. They said he already has something in the works to protect, you know, Jewish Americans, specifically Jewish students. We'd love for you to speak with him at a conference about it. And I showed up to a conference in Miami, and the president of the United States called me up to the presidential podium, and I spoke about my lawsuit. And 3 days later, he signed the executive order on anti-Semitism, which expanded the definition of Judaism from a religion that's faith-based to an ethno-religion, and thereby falling all ethnic protections, including Title VI of the Civil Rights Act.
There are people that are going to hear this and are going to be like, fucking amazing. And then there are people that are going to hear this and say, fucking amazing. I wish it wasn't Trump.
Yep.
And what do you tell those people?
I talk about this all the time. I'm a Mexican national. When the Trump team called me, the first thing I said was, you know, I'm not a U.S. citizen. They said, we're aware. I said, you know, I am Mexican. They said, we are aware. I said, I don't give pre-written speeches. They said, we're not asking you to give one. And, you know, I went up, I said my piece, and the executive order came. And it doesn't matter if you like where it came from or if you don't, it did a good thing. Mm. It did a good thing, and you have to recognize it for what it is. And especially if it's someone that you do not agree with, when they do a good thing, you should celebrate that because then maybe they'll do more of it, right? Mm. I'm not a boycotter ever. So for example, if you take the former president, and he's still the current president, the president of Mexico, López Obrador, who I think is a bona fide idiot, who I do not respect. But if he would have called me and he said, anti-Semitism is a big problem in Mexico. I'd love for you to come and speak about it at a conference. I have something in the works to deal with it. I'm taking that platform. 100% I'm taking that platform. And I'll celebrate
about,
the executive order.
Let me challenge you. What about the incoming president?
Claudia Sheinbaum.
She has been very anti-Israel.
Yeah, she has.
What if she gives you a call and says?
I would take the platform too. And I would celebrate whatever action she does that is positive. If she says, I want to recognize, you know, the October 7th massacre and Hamas is a terrorist organization, I should say, no, because I don't like your platform. Or no, because in the past you've done bad things. Or no, because you're a self-proclaimed socialist. I don't agree with her, but I don't see standing on stage as an endorsement. And I don't see celebrating a good act as an endorsement. I see it as an endorsement of that act. Again, if a good thing is done, you celebrate where it comes from. I would have taken that stage and I would have done the same exact thing and celebrated it the same level that I celebrated it had it been Obama, Trump, or Biden. In any case, because it was a good thing that was done. And again, I think it incentivizes more good actions. At the same time, I don't think that it should blind us to things that are problematic within that person's administration. Again, if the president of Mexico passed an act against anti-Semitism, I'd be very happy. I would talk about it. But I wouldn't exactly put it as like the carrot to the Jewish community saying, and that's why you should continue to vote for him. Because I think that that's where it gets a little bit complicated. Yeah. I think that you should review candidates holistically. But when they do a good thing, you should celebrate that. And, you know, especially if you look at my platform in general, my general audiences are Hispanics and college students, none of which are fans of Trump. So I do have to do a lot of explaining as to why I took a platform or why I'll celebrate a good thing. So it's not the first time I've been challenged on that, and I'll continue to do it, especially as a foreign national. This isn't my country, but I have a stake in it, and I want this to be my country. And if the incumbent president does a good thing, I will celebrate it.
So what's next for Adela?
That's a great question. So what's next?
You just graduated law school.
I did.
Congratulations. Not NYU law.
No, they didn't want me back. Can you believe it?
And if I remember correctly, you got into almost every law school you applied to other than NYU.
Yeah, I got waitlisted. Ultimately, they didn't want me either, but I got waitlisted to Harvard, to Georgetown, to Columbia, to Cornell, to UChicago. I got waitlisted to everyone. I was rejected only by Yale, which I understand is Yale, and NYU. Which, like, if Harvard is like, this girl's interesting, we'll waitlist her. And so is every other T14.
You're a lawyer, so you're probably a good speller. How do you spell retaliation?
Oh, I actually am not good at spelling. I have a fun anecdote about that if we had the time.
So what's next?
That's a great question. So I finished law school, and my whole law school career, I've been gearing up to be a prosecutor. I've worked for the Brooklyn DA, I've worked for the, you know, Queens DA, I've worked, I've gone in, like, you know, the Jersey City DA, like, I've really wanted to build my career as a prosecutor, and the way I saw my career going was, I'll fight for justice for 5-6 years, and then hopefully I'll do a debut in politics, right? That was my whole entire goal, fight for justice, debut in politics. But now, everything changed after October 7th, because after October 7th, yes, I was still going to my law school classes, I still had my internships, but I was getting calls every day from Jewish students on their campuses that were afraid, and that said, what can I do here? And, you know, from parents who are concerned, from organizations that were concerned, from schools saying, can you come in and talk to our high schoolers? Because they're going into college next year. They're just graduating. It's October or it's November or it's January. They're getting their college acceptances in. Do we tell them to go or not? And next thing you know, I'm barely going to my law school classes. I'm going to maybe 2 or 3 classes a week, 2 or 3 days a week. And I realized that, well, everyone, not everyone.
What are
everyone,
you doing instead?
Well, anyone can be a good lawyer. I need to be a good activist. And again, I wasn't born an activist. I was born an advocate, and I'll continue to do advocacy work when it comes to the legal side. I'm never leaving that, of course. And I'm taking the bar exam in 6 weeks. I was doing my bar prep on my way here. I'm taking the bar exam. I will be a lawyer, and I will continue to do legal advocacy. But right now, I need to be an activist. So what I'm going to be doing is exactly what I've been doing for the last 7-8 months since October 7th. I'm speaking. I'm speaking everywhere I can. I'm speaking to every Jewish student. I'm going to be there as a resource. Because you know what? When I sued NYU, it was just me against one school. And right now, if you see, there's dozens of schools being sued. And every single school has 4, 5, 6 plaintiffs. Columbia has over 200. It's one of those things that Jewish students are in this awakening that I've been waiting for so long, where they're realizing, number one, they deserve their rights, and number two, they're not alone. I would have loved to have a group of students suing with me.
Do you feel vindicated, or do you feel angry that it took so long for the world to wake up?
I feel a little bit of both. But you know what? When I speak to Jewish students, not in yeshiva day schools, weirdly enough, but when I speak to Jewish students that are in public schools, I get so much hope because they're dealing with the same fight I dealt with on my college campus much earlier, and they're ready for the fight. And they're getting, you know, like the fact that whenever I speak to a high school, Jewish or non-Jewish, I always tell them, when I was in your seat, in your place, I didn't have this. And you're starting way further ahead than I ever was. And if you would have told me when I was a senior in high school that in 4 years I'd be suing my university for anti-Semitism, then meeting a sitting president of the United States and helping contribute to an executive order that changes the application of a law on a national level, I would have been like, huh, that's a little bit insane. But end of the day, the sky really is the limit. And when these students understand that they're going into college and they have rights and they deserve to use them, that's the difference, because I had to figure that out for myself. And it took me until my senior year to figure that out.
Hey, if you told me a year ago that I'll be having a podcast about Jewish civil rights with you, I'd be like, what are you talking about? When you start fighting, things happen. Things happen.
I agree. It's a weird churn of events, right? Like I thought I was going to be a lawyer, and you know, I was concerning myself with
lawyer
things. I am, but at least for now, I think that my talents are better served elsewhere, and I think that I have a lot more to give than writing a complaint or drafting a contract.
I'm glad we have you. So every episode, I try to end with what I've been calling a Jewish lightning round.
Okay.
A series of questions. There's no right or wrong answers. Just answer the first thing that comes to mind, and you get one pass. I get to decide if you get it. Adela, what is one thing people don't know about you?
About me? I used to religiously play Pokemon Go.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we're just like everyone else. I'm not going to say Jews. I'm going to say Sephardic Jews. That our food is phenomenal and amazing. And when you think Jewish food, you shouldn't just think kugel and cholent. You should really expand your horizons.
What's your favorite?
Kibbeh lachmajin.
Wait, kubeh lach. So in Hebrew, I think in Israel, we'd call it kubeh lachmajun.
Yes. Okay. I mean, they're two separate foods. One of them's like a meat torpedo. The other one's like a meat pizza. But either way.
I like the vegetarian option because I'm vegetarian.
Oh, well, you know, I have vegetarian options. Yeah.
Vegetarian Kuba. What is your favorite curse?
My favorite curse? In what, in Hebrew or in general?
Hebrew, English, Arabic, Spanish.
Okay. I'd have to say, I've never been asked this before.
You stub your toe at the middle of the night or you see Nick Fuentes, you know.
Ironically, and no one's expecting this, like people are expecting like gesechtek or gesemek because that's Arabic and that's what comes innately, I guess. But like if I stub my toe in the middle of the night, I'm saying Jesus. Isn't that weird?
We'll leave it at that. when was the last time you cried?
The last time I cried was actually this past weekend. I got into an argument about my sister that ended in me saying the words, I just want you to know that if it comes down to it, I will compromise my happiness for you. And I don't know what came about, but yeah, that's the last time I cried.
If you could have any person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Okay, it's not that deep, but my grandma, Alah Shalom, she passed away when I was about 12 years old. And anecdote, people like to say I'm the continuation of her and that I got to do what she did had she been born into a different time. My grandma was born in Lebanon, got married at 16, had my mom almost right away, fled her house, went to Canada, had my mom, came down to Mexico, became the perfect wife, had, you know, 5 kids. And then she started taking classes in a local university and she had a neo-Nazi professor and she started raising hell. And when I say raising hell, it got to the point that he ended up moving to Argentina. And no one would listen to her.
Where neo-Nazis run away to.
But no one would listen to her. She brought the complaint up with the school. She even tried to get it to the government level, and it was just not possible. And everyone kept saying, why are you doing this? Why are you concerning yourself with this? You shouldn't have been in college in the first place. She ultimately ended up writing a book, and everyone says that that fight against that professor is something that really like grounded her in the way she lived her life. And they said she changed from that point on. And then if you fast forward now, I sue a school for anti-Semitism.
What's the name of the book?
I don't know. I'm going to have to get it. You know, I've never even read it.
Okay. By the next time I have you here, you need to tell me about the book.
I will.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Favorite Jewish holiday is Purim. Not because of the dressing up and the drinking, but because it's the holiday of advocacy. It's where we didn't win a battle through a fight or through war. We won through someone placing themselves in a position where they can make a difference.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Least favorite Jewish holiday? I'd have to say, I hate to say Sukkot, but I'll tell you why Sukkot. I think it's fun because it's my favorite one to explain to people, but when it backs into weekends and it just becomes like, we just have to sit in this hut, like, I just feel like I'm like, I have to be in the Sukkah, like, I feel like it just, like, keeps my movement, like, it restricts my movement, and I don't necessarily like that. I like to be free.
When do you feel safest?
I feel safest when I'm with my mom and my siblings.
When do you feel least safe?
I feel least safe when I open TikTok.
What gives you hope?
Speaking to high school students and realizing they're years ahead from where I was.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Where do I want people to donate to this week? Oh, Don't worry. Let me think. I'm actually, you know what? Yeah, I have one. And this is just, it's something that's very niche and it might not resonate with everyone, but there's a new organization called La Voz. And what they're doing is they're trying to bring Spanish-speaking content out into the ether of Instagram and TikTok when it comes to Israel and everything that's happening after October 7th. If we think that whatever media war we have is being lost in the United States, in Latin America, it's even worse because we do not have the content. So I think it's a very underserved market when we think about it, and it's a very large population of people who align with us when it comes to having religious values, with the fact that the Jewish people are from the state of Israel. All of these things are already an uphill battle everywhere else, and it's really a market that can be radicalized so far against us that no one's even trying to win.
Mm. Adela, where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Adela Kojav. It's spelled with a J because I'm Mexican, and that's just how it is.
C-O-J...
C-O-J-A-B. Adela Kojav on Instagram. I'm no longer on TikTok for obvious reasons. And you can find me on LinkedIn, but no one's ever on LinkedIn.
Well, Kojav, your last name means star, and you are definitely a shining star. So thank you very much for being here with me, and here I am with Adela Kojav.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."